Welcome to CPA Australia Sound Business, podcasting for business and the accounting profession.
Welcome to today's podcast. My name is Mark Morris. I'm a senior tax counsel with CPA Australia. It's my great pleasure today to invite our special guest, Ray Cummings, to lead us through some of the issues you may wish to consider in discussing succession planning with your clients. Ray is a principal with Green Oak Advisory, a qualified solicitor, tax agent and accountant who specialises in providing tax advice, amongst other things, to privately held groups. He's also been a very good friend to CPA Australia over many years. Ray, it's a great pleasure to have you here today. Thanks for making the time.
Thanks, Mark. Pleasure to be here.
When people talk about a succession plan, what do they actually mean?
Mark, that's a good question. It can actually mean different things to different people, ranging from a sale of the business entity, bringing kids into the family business or bringing management into the business. At the other end of the spectrum, it mightn't be about a sell down or a dilution. It might actually be about growing the business, but quite often with a sale in mind in the background.
So is succession planning different from estate planning?
Look, to my mind, they're very clearly different. Estate planning, by definition, involves what happens to a person's assets when they die. And more often than not, this also includes passing control of entities such as trusts. Now, theoretically, a succession plan should include what happens to assets when you're alive, but also when you die. But people quite often like to separate the two. And they treat them as separate exercises. In particular, they like to defer their estate planning because they don't like to contemplate their own death.
Which I guess is a very common human reaction, isn't it?
Absolutely.
So where do you start on a succession plan? It sounds like it could be a lengthy process.
Yes, it can be a very lengthy process. What might sound obvious is that a large part of the process is helping people to articulate what it is that they actually want. And that's before you get into the process that accountants like of collecting, you know, the structure charts and the financial statements and the like.
Yes.
So you really need to sit down with the client and ask them what they want to do, and often just as important or even more important is why. And this really helps with the whole process and lets both the advisor and the client understand where they're headed.
So I guess often you're more of a confidant to the business owner rather than just a tax advisor, in the sense that you'd probably be not only talking about business and tax issues, but sometimes acting as a counsellor almost.
Look, over the years, I've often found myself in a position where I'm talking to the business owners about issues that have absolutely nothing to do with tax.
Yes.
Quite often you're the only person they can open up to about various issues. You find out what the go and the no-go zones are, and quite often you find out a lot about the personalities of family members, the management team. It can get quite emotional, and sometimes you think, well, maybe you should stop. I don't think I want to hear all of this.
Yes. So you're talking about getting down to the detail and collating structure charts, financials and the like before. I assume that can be a fairly lengthy process. Do you have a particular process or plan that you follow?
Look, I have a broad framework that I follow. I suppose, firstly, as I said, you sit down with the client to work out the what, the why, the who and the when. The second step is the detailed step of collating the various background information. So that's the structure charts and the financials and everything, valuations that I spoke about before. Third step is to work out the how part. So that obviously involves the detailed analysis, modelling, set out the transaction steps, determine what the tax consequences are. And then the last one is, after all of that is agreed and approved by the client, by the business owner, to move towards implementation.
And I guess that could be a lengthy process at times, because what might start as the original plan gets modified for family considerations or other issues. In other words, you know.
Correct. Quite often something will happen within the family or the business that changes where you started and you need to modify it.
Well, let's move to some of the tax issues. No doubt these depend on the client situation, but can you give an indication of some of the type of tax issues you commonly encounter?
Not surprisingly, Mark, the key issues that I often encounter in these areas are capital gains tax and the employee share plan provisions.
Can we explore some of the CGT issues? Obviously, where there's a disposal of shares or an interest in a business or of underlying CGT assets, there's a CGT event. Are there any kind of other GST issues you'd consider other than those kind of standard CGT events?
Yes, look, there certainly are, and this is probably in the category of what I would describe as traps for young players, and in fact also traps for old players. There are a couple of sleepers in a situation that appears fairly innocuous. Let's say mum and dad have a private company and they decide to issue shares to the kids.
Yep.
Now, obviously, that's fairly easy to do this day. You know, these days you log on the internet and, hey, presto, you've issued the new shares. So the first thing the accountant finds out about it is that it's already been done.
Yep.
Now, the problem with that is that if you have a pre-CGT structure, then that may have actually freshened up the underlying pre-CGT assets within the company. Or, as a minimum, if you haven't done that, the new shares that you've issued are obviously post-CGT, so you've diluted mum and dad's pre-capital gains tax holding.
So what are the implications of those, issuing those post-CGT shares rather than, say, pre-CGT shares?
Yes, if the shares in the company are post-CGT, then that takes you to a slightly different place. People don't really think about it. They just issue the shares.
Yes.
And where you end up with is bang smack into the CGT value shifting provisions.
Which are god-awful, aren't they?
Absolutely, and can actually have the consequence that you were trying to avoid, and that is mum and dad pay tax as if they'd dispose of their shares to the kids anyway.
Yeah, and often may not be detected for years too. That's another problem, isn't it?
Absolutely.
Might trigger and only found out on audit.
Absolutely right.
Without getting into too much detail, what are the broad issues in relation to employee share plans that you mentioned before?
Look, again, a very simplistic example. Let's say that the owner of a company decides to issue, let's say, $10,000 worth of shares to an employee for free. Now, that runs straight into the employee share plan provisions, and you end up having a discussion around payment of tax, which in the standard case, the employee would have a tax liability on issue of those shares.
And again, that might not be, you know, the client may not be aware of that exposure. Isn't there an opportunity to defer the tax under the employee share provisions?
There is an opportunity to defer, but you have to design the plan so that there's a real risk of forfeiture. That is, that the employee has the prospect of losing those shares, say, if
yes,
they don't meet certain performance criteria. So what happens there is that the tax is deferred until that later point in time. That is when that real risk of forfeiture disappears, but your tax import is deferred, but you pay tax on the value of the shares at that point in time. So let's say they've gone up from $10,000 to $20,000, then the employee pays tax on the $20,000.
Yep. So it truly is just a deferral on, obviously, you know, you expect that many cases share value would increase. Let's come back to the process of working through the succession plan. Is this the sort of thing that should be set out in a formal document?
Needless to say, Mark, clients are often reticent to pay fees for something in which they don't see any value. So for a simple transaction such as a transfer of shares, you probably just go ahead and do it without any formal documentation. But you can imagine a situation where you have a private business group and there are significant value of assets, there are multiple entities, you've got some held individually, some in a trust, other assets in a superannuation fund. So the degree of complexity multiplies. So in that case, it's often necessary and advisable to set out the whole process in a formal document. Now, the other advantage of that document is not only does it set out the transaction steps, but it forms the basis for implementation of the whole succession plan.
Yes. And that could be particularly important where you've got a disparate group, as you mentioned, you know, with a variety of different entities, and you need that clarity. On the issue of implementation, how do you see the accountant's role in helping the client implement the succession plan?
Probably depends on whether an accountant or a lawyer is asking that question, Mark.
You're both. Go on, you should know.
It's a bit of a vexed issue, and some clients, in trying to determine whether the lawyer or the accountant should be driving the process. Now, in my view, there's no right or wrong answer in the sense that the accountant can either take a central role and coordinate all the advisors, or they can be there in a support role.
Yep.
Now, let's take that situation of a large private group. There are a lot of issues, a lot of complex issues, so it's important that all of the advisors are working together to make sure that there's complete coverage of the business issues, the accounting issues, the tax issues, and the legal issues. So really working together on that as a team.
So do you generally find that once the succession plan's been agreed, it's a fairly straightforward case of just implementing the plan, or are there delays?
There are often delays, Mark, and I'm trying not to laugh in terms of succession plans being straightforward, anything but quite often. Look, for something like an issue of equity to employees, the implementation can be fairly straightforward because the decision's already been made and you just issue the shares. For other succession planning issues, as we were discussing before, the owner quite often goes through the process and they'll sit on it. Sometimes for years. You know, it's a bit like trying to convince someone that they should undertake their estate planning. No one likes to contemplate their own death, as we said, so that's why they put off the estate planning. Very, very similarly, with a succession plan, private business owners don't like to hand over control or contemplate that perhaps they're no longer going to be involved in the business that they've built up over years and sometimes decades.
Yeah, I imagine it could be quite confronting at times.
It certainly is.
Do you have any final reflections on your involvement in succession plans?
Probably back to where we started, Mark, and that is that advisors need to be able to articulate the fundamental roles to the client at the outset and not to overly complicate things by, say, jumping straight into the tax consequences.
Yeah.
So, as we've discussed, the client needs to understand the critical role that they have in determining those key issues, the what, the why, the who, and the when. And the advisor's first task is to listen. And then to help the client articulate the plan. And then only after all that has been done should the advisor sit down and work out the how.
Okay, right. Look, thank you very much for kind of going through that. I've always heard the expression succession planning, and I think no one's put it more succinctly than you have for me today. Thanks very much.
Thanks, Mark.
I look forward to future podcasts going forward on similar issues. Thanks a lot,
Mark. Thanks, Mark. Thank you.